Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is April 25th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
And Angela Meaden.
Hi, guys.
Starting off, as always, with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
Yesterday was the 24th of April, and it marked the 21st birthday of the Hubble Space Telescope. The HST was built by NASA with contributions from the European Space Agency and is operated by the Space Telescope Science Institute. It is named after the awesome astronomer Edwin Hubble, who you might know from things like the Hubble Constant.
Quite a guy, that guy.
Shut up! When the HST was launched in 1990, scientists found that the main mirror had been ground incorrectly, and the telescope's optics were pretty much unusable. Any pictures that I saw from back then were very blurry. So 3 years later, they sent up a shuttle full of astronauts to do a servicing mission, and they repaired the optics, and the telescope was restored to its intended quality and has been delivering amazing science ever since. One of the most well-known results of the HST is probably Hubble's ultra deep field image, which is the most detailed visible light image ever made of the universe's most distant objects. Many Hubble observations have led to breakthroughs in astrophysics, such as accurately determining the rate of expansion of the universe, which is the Hubble constant, and that is approximately 72 plus or minus 8 kilometers per second per megaparsec.
Awesome.
What does that mean?
It means it's expanding quickly.
But what is a megaparsec?
A parsec is a unit of length equal to just under 31 trillion kilometers. Okay, see?
Trillion!
which is about 3.26 light years. So a megaparsec would then be a million parsecs.
So that's huge. That's many times the diameter of our galaxy.
Yes.
The Hubble Space Telescope isn't just another telescope. I mean, everybody knows the Hubble Space Telescope images. I think that this one instrument has done more for the public appreciation of science in the 20th and 21st century than any other. Because even somebody who knows nothing about astrophysics can appreciate the awe-inspiring beauty of some of these shots. I mean, the Pillars of Creation, one of Hubble's first images with its corrected optics, is instantly recognizable to just about anybody.
And Hubble's successor, the James Webb Telescope, which is going to be focused, it's not a direct successor because unlike Hubble, it's not primarily an optical telescope. It will focus more on the infrared, but it'll go up in 2015 and its mirror will be, I think, two or three times as large, at around 6 meters. And because if you put it in space, there's no reason to worry about the atmosphere and the distorting effects it has. And because a space telescope is above our atmosphere, there's no distorting effects. And James Webb promises to reveal even more and more awesome things about the universe.
Hi, I'm Carl Zimmer from The Loom, and you're listening to Consilience.
Right, we have no listener feedback this week, so we're moving straight into the news. And first up, we have a story about peacock tails.
You'll probably remember from a couple of weeks ago in our Evolution 101 segment, we talked a bit about the peacock's tail and sexual selection. And there is a new study out that I'll be discussing a little bit this week. For a long time, the peacock's tail has been the canonical example of sexual selection.
Sorry, canonical?
Canonical, it means the defining case, like the Christian canon, the Gospels.
Like Star Trek canon, right? So the original series, Next Generation, all of those are canon.
Where's that taser?
But the animated series and the novels, those are non-canon. Okay, all right.
Right.
Sorry, carry on.
So the peacock's tail has long been the canonical example of sexual selection. Darwin proposed that there's competition between members of the same sex in a species for access to the opposite sex. And this competition can take many forms, the horn of a stag or odd displays or whatever the case might be.
And Ferraris in the case of humans.
Ferraris, yes, in the case of humans. The idea is that even though the peacock's tail may reduce its fitness in some ways by making it easier to catch, the individual male gains because the female picks the peacock with the nicest tail And over time, the merest fancy of the female has resulted in an arms race between males to have bigger and bigger tails. And as a result, you get these absurdly large tails. Now, while it's been intuitively clear that the peacock's tail must be sexually selected, experimental confirmation is always needed because our intuitions often mislead us. And amazingly, even though Darwin proposed this theory of sexual selection in, I think it was the 1870s or so, the first experimental evidence on the peacock tail was only collected in the 1980s or so. And the results of these experiments have been somewhat ambiguous. Quite a bit of research has concluded that it's the number of eye spots that determine female choice. So if you look at a peacock's tail, it has a little spot on it that looks like an eye. So it's called an eye spot. And
that's the round disc-shaped thing. It's at the end of the long tail feathers.
Yeah. So it's a round eye-looking kind of shape on the actual feather. And the idea has been that the females look at the tail, so the males engage in a display behavior where they lift up their tails and they sort of prance around trying to impress the females. And the hypothesis has long been it's that the females subconsciously count the number of eye spots and then favor the male with the largest number of spots. And there's some evidence that males with the largest number of spots are the genetically the healthiest. And so that was an accepted explanation for a while. But in 2008, a Japanese group published a study saying that eye spots had no influence on female choice. And this study was conducted over 7 years, very thorough, and it confirmed findings from other bird species as well. So it seemed to be the case that the eye spots don't actually influence female choice. Now, a new study in the journal Animal Behavior by Rosalind Duncan and Robert Montgomery at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, has waded into this debate. And so their principal findings were that while it's true that if you experimentally trim the tails, you dramatically reduce the male's success. So if you cut 20 spots off the male's tail, his success is going to be reduced. However, there's little variation in the wild population's eyes. So most males have the same number of spots on average. So they almost have all the same spots. And the considerable variation, and I'm quoting from the abstract, the considerable variation in the mating success of feral peacocks cannot be explained by the natural variation in the number of eye spots visible in the train or the tail. What this study has found seems to be that they've confirmed the Japanese study, which I jokingly dismissed earlier, and it seems to be the case that it's not the number of eye spots in the tail that determines which male the females pick. Now, this research should not be misunderstood. It's not that the tail doesn't matter. It's more that we don't know what it is about the tail that matters. So the females are making a choice and picking some males, and their choice clearly drives the evolution of the tail, but we don't know what it is about the tail that makes it attractive to the female. So, for example, most men could tell you what an attractive female looks like, but very few will know exactly what it is about the female that makes her attractive. Nobody discovered through introspection that bilateral facial symmetry was important until research was conducted, or that if you average lots of female faces, the average face is more attractive to men than even the prettiest female that occurs naturally.
And I think that average is quite an important point, because in this article they specifically mention that the males with fewer spots than average suffer in terms of how many times the females will choose them, but males with more spots than average don't seem to have any particular advantage.
Yeah, sure, that's right. So what that means, if you reduce the number drastically by cutting 20 off, then you reduce their success. But there's not enough variation in feral populations for males with a couple of more spots to gain a significant advantage. So yeah, that's right. One little wrinkle that could be interesting to do that I believe no one has done yet is to see whether giving males larger tails, so they've so far cut some tail feathers off and shown that this reduces the mating success, but no one has yet figured out how to artificially make tails larger or longer and to see whether that then makes the male super attractive. I know there's an experiment from about 20 or 30 years ago where someone took an African species of birds of paradise who also have these
ridiculously long tail. They're just black and very long. And then cut some males' tails shorter and artificially made other males' tails much longer. And these males succeeded dramatically. They had far more females with them. So would the same result be found with super competitive males of, say, 20% more spots than the average feral male? That's not been established. So that could be interesting.
Sounds like a market for spammers. Performance enhancing treatments for peacocks.
So we can file this under, it's always more complicated than you think, as even though it seems intuitively obvious what's going on in the peacock peahen's brain, we actually don't know even after 2-3 decades of research.
Yeah, who knows what women want?
No, I got nothing.
Our next news item concerns new Australopithecus sediba skeletons. Owen?
That's right. We've got some interesting skeletons that have been dug out of the ground in our backyard. About a year ago, Lee Berger and colleagues out of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg announced a discovery of a new species of hominin called Australopithecus sediba. Now, hominin is an ape species of the human family, so they are either ancestors or relatively close cousins. Australopithecus sediba lived between 2 and 3 million years ago, which is an interesting period in human development because we don't have a lot of fossil evidence from that area, from that time period, which means that sediba is one of the most promising candidates for human ancestral species that we have at the moment. It's not the only one. There are others, but it's still on that list. Now, about a year after that initial announcement, Berger and colleagues have announced they've discovered even more fragments from the exact same site as the Malapa Caves. Now, Malapa Caves are near Sterkfontein, which is in the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site, which is here in Gauteng province in South Africa. Berger announced at a meeting of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists that they found more fragments of the same two skeletons, including parts of the skull, which is significant because now we can get a better idea of the shapes of the brains of these people, as well as two other individuals, one of whom is an 18-month-old infant, so they found a toddler. Well, what's significant about these new finds is that they still have not ruled out sediba as a candidate for the Homo sapiens ancestral line, although these particular individuals wouldn't have been in that ancestral line because at this time early species of the Homo genus already existed. So if Australopithecus sediba is ancestral to Homo, it would have split off sometime before these individuals lived, probably around 3 million years ago. So these individuals would have been late surviving members of a species that has since gone extinct. So what's interesting here is that even if this is an evolutionary dead end, that's still a very valuable find because this period in time, 2 to 3 million years ago, is largely unexplored when it comes to the human evolutionary story.
And what you have here is the battle between the two sides of the story. You have the east side story, the idea that human beings or the Homo genus evolved in East Africa, in Kenya, Tanzania, and the candidate there is Lucy, the type specimen of Australopithecus afarensis, and sediba is a new candidate for the link between or the transition from Australopithecus to Homo. So it's an example of the south side story, the idea that the Homo genus evolved in Southern Africa. It's hard for a non-specialist to tell, and the article we have here from Scientific American on this topic has quite a few details, but a lot of the scientists they approached for comment noted that it's too early to tell because this is just presentation at a conference, which is always preliminary. You have to wait for a published paper in a peer-reviewed journal with direct morphological comparisons between sediba and other Homo and Australopithecus skeletons before we will be able to determine exactly where on the human line, if at all, Australopithecus sediba finds itself. And there's an interesting sociological thing that goes on in paleoanthropology or the study of early human origins. And that's it. It's paleoanthropology is an extremely vicious field. There are all these animosities and rivalries and people fighting. And it's unclear exactly why it's the case. I mean, science is often quite, you know, vicious. People tear each other's ideas apart all the time at conferences and papers and, you know, go crazy. But anthropology seems to be especially prone to this kind of thing, possibly because they have so few specimens to work with. I mean, we have fragments from a few thousand individuals at most for all of human evolutionary history. And as a result, people get quite attached to their own finds. And you find people like Donald Johansson, who works works in East Africa, believes that, you know, the fossils he happens to find are on the Homo line, and Lee Berger works in South Africa, and so therefore the fossils he finds are on the human line. And, you know, and there's all sorts of dodgy practices going on, like people hiding skeletons, not letting other people see them, locking up them up in safes. In fact, I'm busy reading a book by Lee Berger called In the Footsteps of Eve, I think it is, published about 10 years ago, in which he discusses these sort of fights between different paleoanthropologists, even in the same department, you know, hiding skeletons from each other and stealing each other's finds, and, you know, all sorts of nastiness happening. So it's very difficult for anyone, for an outsider especially, to determine how good the evidence is. But it's a very interesting find.
At this meeting of the AAPA, there were other anthropologists who examined the fossils, and these researchers agreed that although the fossils were interesting and at first glance had very tantalizing modern features, such as they had an elongated pelvis, smaller teeth, shorter fingers, and an elongated thumb, so it was more sort of the proportions that we see in our own skeletons, but they have pointed out that this needs to be examined more closely and directly contrasting other early Homo and Australopithecus skeletons before we place Sidiba on the human ancestral line.
I think this is an example of science that at its funnest. Anybody who says that science is dull and boring, I point them to paleoanthropology. This is better than any WWE bout.
Oh, yeah. Give me this over Days of Our Lives any day.
I have a prediction. Donald Johansson is going to publish or say something somewhere disparaging this find. This is my prediction, and we'll see next week whether it actually comes true. And just a little side note, if you are interested in physical anthropology at all, I highly recommend the blog by John Hawkes. It's called John Hawkes Anthropology Blog. Very creative. And he is a professional physical anthropologist who works in the States, and he regularly blogs about new finds and evolution and everything to do with paleoanthropology. And it's very good, and I highly recommend it. I'll link to it on the show notes.
So from ancient African history to something a little bit more modern, we have reports this week in the newspaper News 24.
Right, our favorite news source.
Again.
Yes. Of a monster that has been terrorizing a small town in the Karoo. The town is called Statlerville, and there have been reports of a shape-changing monster that is seen only at night, and there's no evidence. There's no pictures or anything. What we've got is anecdotes, people who have seen this thing changing from a man into a pig, into a bat, and flying off. So the local policeman has requested photographs. He wants evidence, but up until now, all we have anecdotes, and this goes on News 24.
Right, of course, because News 24 carries the news. Hard hitting journalism, that's what this is. But you know, it's interesting though that it's only ever seen in the dark.
Yes.
You know how hard it is to see things in the dark?
Yes.
Now, I've never been to Statlerville. I've never even heard of it before. So it's not central Joburg, right? We don't have floodlights covering the, you know, every square centimeter. It's probably pretty dark out there in the Karoo at night. So they're seeing things changing shape from men into pigs into bats in the dark.
And near a church, if that helps.
Yes. And we should mention that the Karoo is an arid, desert-like area in south of where we are, a couple of hundreds of kilometers. So it's basically South Africa's desert.
I don't know how much we can really say about this, other than it's something that's being trumpeted, but we've got nothing.
Even in South Africa, where we have this whole third world economy thing going on, just about everybody has a cell phone, and just about every cell phone has a camera in it. Even in the Karoo, I imagine, a lot of the people who claim to have seen this thing probably were carrying a camera with them. Why didn't they snap a photo?
But we should also mention that this is not new or surprising. These kinds of stories crop up all the time. I remember a year or two ago reading of an Indian village up in arms, by Indian I mean actually in India, up in arms about some monster stealing their cattle. And, you know, you have the chupacabra in the States and in Mexico and various monsters. And it's typical human nature to attribute something you can't really see. Who knows? It could have been a hare. It could have been just a shadow. shadow, it could have been anything. And suddenly a mythology builds up around a monster that people assume because it's, they couldn't immediately identify what it was, therefore it's something unknown to science. This jump from I don't know to nobody knows that a lot of people seem to fall for. It's the argument from incredulity. And we should note that this kind of evidence is always deeply problematic. It's not to say that there can't be critters in the Karoo we don't know about. Here's me hoping that it's a dinosaur that somehow has survived in the last 65 million years and runs around the Karoo and just happens to have been found now. That would be awesome. I'd be driving there tomorrow morning to go see the thing. So I really hope it is a real monster, right? But, you know, until you have some evidence other than a couple of locals whose state of sobriety is unknown saying, you know, something happened, until we have something a little bit more tantalizing than that. And even photo evidence is usually not good enough because it's hard to identify what the photos are, even especially if it's in the dark. So shoot the thing and hope it's not the last one of its kind. And then, you know, phone the nearest university and have a zoologist come around and look at the thing. And another interesting thing with monsters, that this happens often with the chupacabra, is that people misidentify animals that are sick. So coyotes or dogs that have some disease and all their hair fall out and they look all weird get misidentified as the chupacabra quite often. And this might just be something like that, although I don't know what disease could possibly explain a man in a suit turning into a pig and then into a bat, other than drugs or alcohol or just deep confusion.
I'm prepared to postulate a hypothesis here. I suspect that there was a man in a suit who was walking along, walked behind something and stopped. Just at that moment, a pig walked out from behind the same thing, then walked behind something else, which then disturbed a bat, which happened to be roosting in that second thing, and flew away.
Which would be more plausible than a shape-shifting monster.
Right, exactly.
Like Michael says, we need some evidence, and I think we should have evidence before we go publishing stories about monsters.
Quite right. One interesting thing about this story, which sets it apart from things like the chupacabra, is that it hasn't harmed anybody. It hasn't attacked anybody or any livestock or anything like that.
Yet.
Which is yet, of course, yet.
Anyone with bat pig man teeth marks in him, kill me.
That also makes it a bit more interesting because it means that there is no physical evidence.
Yeah.
At least when you have livestock mutilation, you have tooth marks and that sort of thing to work off of. But here there isn't even that, which is interesting.
Maybe it's Bigfoot has decided to move to the Karoo and it flew on a UFO.
Right.
And I don't know, brought
a unicorn.
Yes, of course.
And he brought a pig along. Anyway, this is just typical human nature. This kind of story has been recorded for as long as we've had books. You know, the same kind of thing is recorded in Herodotus, the history, you know, from 500 BC.
Right.
Show off.
Everybody has read Herodotus, right?
Totally.
Okay, so another bit of Karoo news is that we have an update on the SKA and a controversial process called fracking. Owen, is this BSG related?
Of course it's BSG related. Everything's BSG related. But no, it's not that kind of fracking. You see, it's spelled different. In Battlestar Galactica, it's spelled F-R-A-K-K-I-N-G. But here we're talking about F-R-A-C-K-I-N-G.
Ah.
So in this context, fracking means a method of extracting oil and other minerals and that sort of thing out of the ground using a technique called hydraulic fracturing, where you drill a well into the ground and you exploit some existing weak points in the rock by forcing high-pressure water jets into the well, which then releases the oil or gas or whatever it is you're trying to extract. So there have been a number of companies that have been trying to get the rights to do some exploratory investigation of the Karoo area, looking for exactly that, natural oil or gas or coal deposits that might be in the area, which has thrown some people up in arms, because our listeners may remember a few weeks ago we spoke about the Square Kilometer Array Telescope and how it's going to be set up in the Karoo. Now, the Karoo is a pretty big area, but it's not that big, right? So the Square Kilometer Array covers quite a large area, and there was concern that this fracking, if the exploratory efforts turn out to be fruitful, could result in some environmental impacts, which may negatively affect the Square Kilometer Array bit.
And it could also have other negative effects. There is quite a lot of flora and fauna, animals and plants that are unique to the mountain zebra, and there's a bunny rabbit as well, who only lives in the Karoo.
Bunny wabbit?
A bunny wabbit.
Oh, no, you have to save the bunnies.
So I can hug them. No.
And of course, there's the Namaqualand and Fynbos, which is not quite the Karoo. It's on the southern edge of the Karoo, but that's also some flora that's unique to the area. So it's potentially quite a sensitive area from a natural environment point of view. And on top of that, in Sutherland, which is a small town sort of in the middle of the Karoo, is where the South African Astronomical Observatory is, where there are a number of large telescopes, including the SALT, South African Large Telescope, which is the largest optical telescope in the southern hemisphere. But if large-scale mining operations were to be implemented in the area, it could potentially have some deleterious effects for the observatory. Things like exhaust fumes from heavy machinery and kicking up dust and radio traffic using communications, these sorts of things could potentially disrupt not only the existing observatory, but a potential SKA. So the news that's come out is that the South African government has imposed a fracking moratorium. They've imposed a moratorium on fracking in the Karoo. Basically, they've temporarily put a stop to these exploratory efforts going on in the area, pending, I presume, some kind of review of the proposal submitted by Sasol, the South African oil company, and various other companies that are interested in that exploratory process.
Oh, that's right. There's going to be a multidisciplinary team that's going to investigate the effect of the fracking and what effects it will have both on these large telescopes and on just the general environment. So it's essentially it's an environmental impact assessment process that's going to take place. And the very nice thing for South Africa, unlike the Australians, I might add, is that we have a piece of legislation called the Astronomy Advantage Act of 2007, I think it is, and this empowers the Minister of Science and Technology, who is Naledi Pandor at the moment, to ban any activity that affects astronomy in a large declared area, which includes the SKA and the SALT. And what Pandor has said, she said, there's no way anything these mining companies do will affect our bids, because if it does, we're just going to shut them down.
To be clear, the impact of fracking on radio astronomy itself is not really a direct impact. The only things about fracking that could have a negative impact is radio communications and the heavy machinery. Now, heavy machinery can't be operated within 12 kilometers of a radio telescope. But Sasol has said publicly if there would be any severe impact on the SKA, they would not frack within that area.
Talking about setting up a no fracking zone.
Oh.
Master of puns today.
We just need to say that there is a controversy, especially in the South African media lately on the website called the Daily Maverick, between pro and con fracking. So whatever its impact on the SKN and astronomy might be, there's also controversy about, you know, the water use and the vulnerable fauna and flora we talked about. And we shouldn't prejudge this process by saying, oh, fracking is an evil process that should stop at, you know, all costs. You do an environmental assessment and then you determine whether the damage that gets done is within an acceptable range. I don't think it's a good idea to become ideological about it and say no damage whatsoever to the Karoo is possibly allowed, because that's just not a practical approach. South Africa has a very large mining industry, and the mining industry does have an impact on the environment, but they also provide money and jobs and so on. So, you know, don't become lefty ideological about it and say fracking is evil and should be stopped. But when it comes to our telescopes, I think all three of us are fairly clear that if any of you guys mess with our telescopes, we're going to be very upset and throw things at you. So we're happy to be ideological in that sense. But as long as the damage is temporary and minimal and does not interfere with the science being conducted in the area, then I'm fairly happy myself for fracking to go on and for the South African economy to benefit from the gas that will get us extracted. And hopefully it will reduce our bills a little bit. But be that as it may, it's a good thing the cabinet has imposed this moratorium. And we'll just see what the study concludes maybe in a year or two.
Frack with our telescopes and we'll frack with you.
I feel a challenge coming along here that somebody is going to log onto our website after listening to this podcast and say, but we must be looking for clean energy alternatives. And I think, yes, we must be, but until those alternatives are viable and are producing enough energy for us to actually abandon fossil fuels, we must make responsible use of what we have.
Right. And as I understand it, there are initiatives underway in the Karoo as well to set up things like wind farms and solar farms and that kind of thing. So it's not like anybody's saying we shouldn't be pursuing those alternatives. Just for now, fossil fuels are still our best and cheapest energy source, and it just makes sense to pursue that at least in the relatively short term.
And let's not pretend that the alternative ways of generating energy have no impact. So wind farms, for example, kill lots and lots of birds.
Yeah.
And bats.
And yeah, they kill bats in various cruel and interesting ways.
It could kill our man-pig bat.
Nobody
wants to.
I think we've discussed that in enough detail for now, guys. Let's move on to our next news article, which is a little bit sad. An Indian gentleman known as Sai Baba has, how do I put this nicely?
Kicked the bucket.
Shuffled up in mortal coil. Has passed away. Yesterday, the 24th of April, Sai Baba passed away. He was an Indian guru and spiritual teacher and performed miracles, she says with scare quotes on the podcast, apparently materializing holy ash and small objects such as rings, necklaces, and watches out of thin air. Devotees of his consider this to be evidence of divinity, but of course, nasty skeptics say he's doing cheap conjuring tricks. So Sai Baba predicted that he would be healthy until the age of 96, whereupon he would die, but he died at 85 years old after a protracted illness and spent much time in a wheelchair since 2005.
So I guess it's not much for predictions, even if he can't manifest small objects.
Yeah, he was incredibly popular. He was a very active philanthropist. He opened free hospitals and schools and gave a lot of food to people in India who didn't have, you know. So he was doing good work, but he became a legend, and he definitely, he didn't discourage it. He embraced his like miracle worker status and used it to his advantage, of course.
And I've always found it interesting that the gurus and mystics conjure up like small little bits of matter. I mean, why don't do an elephant or,
right.
I don't know.
Nice.
Yeah, something, a crocodile or, you know, something.
5,000 cheeseburgers.
Yeah, something that would actually impress anyone. It always seems to be that these gurus can do no more and usually quite a bit less than a well-trained magician.
Well, not even a well-trained magician. An average magician could probably conjure up rings and other palm-sized trinkets.
Yes, pocket-sized.
Yes.
And what Baba illustrates is the origin of religion. Often people think all the religions that have been, that can be founded have already been founded. But that's just not true. You can easily see if Sai Baba lived 400 or 500 years ago and we, you know, didn't have people questioning him in a skeptical way, how a whole religious movement or a cult could have developed around him by now that could have been several million people strong. In fact, there's a very interesting article that I highly recommend on the blog Free Thought Kampala about Sai Baba and comparing him to Jesus Christ. And the interesting thing is, on the reasons or the reasons cited by Christian apologists for the divinity of Jesus Christ, those criteria, when applied to Sai Baba, you have to conclude that he's divine as well.
Well, I guess we'll find out tomorrow whether or not he also manages to do the third day resurrection shtick.
Oh, we are terrible.
Sorry.
We could speak about this guy for hours because the myths and the legends and the stories just abound, but there is no evidence. There's nothing that's been allowed to be tested. So it's just, you know, he's a popular guy. He was good with magic tricks.
No, he wasn't good. He was mediocre.
No, he was average. I'm curious to see what will happen to his cult now that he's gone. A lot of these sorts of cults tend not to survive very long after the death of their central figure. Some do, like Scientology, which is not a cult. Mormonism, of course, also survived, and Christianity, of course, survived too, assuming Jesus ever actually existed. That's another discussion. But this does tend to be a fairly rare thing. When these cults pop up all over the place and all the time, but once the central figure, once their messiah figure has died, they tend to fall apart. So I'll be curious to see if Sai Baba's cult will live much longer.
Well, they're estimated to have around 6 million members.
It's pretty big.
In 178 wow. countries. So these guys are not, you know, they're not small. There's a substantial following that Sai Baba had collected. So.
Interesting. Yep. So we'll see.
Give him another few hundred years and he might be the dominant religion. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Who knows? Possible. All right, our last news item for today talks about research into precognition that has been replicated. Last year, Daryl Bem of Cornell University published an article in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, which is a fairly prestigious journal, that found alleged evidence for psi, which is psychic powers. Basically, he took some famous experimental methodologies and ran them backwards, the idea being to try and see if he could determine that effect preceded cause. So he was trying to get to prove that some of his subjects had a limited capability to tell what was going to happen in the future. He then published his paper in the prestigious journal, and then everybody lost their minds. Because one of the most controversial things about this paper is that it all seems to have been done above board. It was all done in with regards to established best practices, and yet still it proved something to be real that can't possibly be real. So there's been a lot of discussion and controversy around in the skeptical community about using this case as an example of how statistics can be misapplied and misinterpreted to yield faulty conclusions. But now what's happened is that several other researchers have replicated Bem's research, and not one of them has managed to replicate his results. I think at last count there were five different researchers, including Richard Wiseman of Quirkology, who have performed that same experiment that Bem did using his same methodologies and have yielded no results. The trouble with these new studies, however, is that they seem to be battling to get published. According to Ben Goldacre of Bad Science, at least three of these studies have approached the same journal that's...
These three guys collaborated on one study. Because Stuart Ritchie, Chris French, and Richard Wiseman had worked together to rerun three of his experiments and then submitted it to the JPSP.
And the JPSP then rejected that submission, saying that they only publish original research. They don't publish material that attempts to replicate prior research. And they seem to have submitted it to various other publications, and none of them seem to be willing to publish them, which is interesting in and of itself. So what this tells us is that there seems to be something broken in the way science is done, in that negative results battle to get published. And that's a problem, because negative results can be as useful and as informative as positive results. And in fact, probably the vast majority of all results from all signs everywhere is negative, because not everything can be true. But that a lot of those negative results just never see the light of day, because the publications don't want to publish it, and the researchers themselves probably don't want to publish it either. It's just it's a messy situation, and this is information we need to see, but we don't see it. Why not?
To be clear, we don't have very much information. There's this column by Ben Goldacre that he published in The Guardian and on his website. But I've looked and looked, but I can't seem to find Ritchie, French, and Wiseman's article. So I can't really comment on the quality of it, was it properly done or anything like that. But it is, if the description of what has gone down, so Wiseman and his colleagues submitted this replication to JPSP, and they just dismissed it out of hand, saying, you know, we don't do replications, which is silly if true. The very essence of science is that you get replicable results. If you do an experiment once, it could just be down to chance. There's a fantastic XKCD cartoon that I'll link to in the show notes explaining why this is the case. And unless you have multiple replications from different people, you're going to end up with lots of false positives. And if journals don't publish negative results, you end up with what is called publication bias, which means that either only positive or negative results get published at all. And what happens is the file drawer effect. People get a study, they don't get a result, and they put it in their file drawer and just keep it there.
Right.
And that is a big problem. From what Goldacre has written is they submitted to JPSB, got rejected, and then submitted it to the journal Science and also got rejected. But it seems that they will submit it elsewhere and hopefully it will get published. I've no doubt they could get it published in PLOS or one of the less famous psychology journals. And it'll be interesting to see what they found.
Indeed. From the looks of Wiseman's website, it looks like they're trying to do a meta-analysis based on these other comparisons, which will also be interesting ones that sees the light of day. So I think we have more updates to look forward to in this area.
Because Richard Wiseman is collecting details of other researchers who have replicated the BEM study, regardless of whether or not they have positive or negative results.
A meta-analysis, to be clear, is when you take results and data from multiple different experiments and pool them all together and then draw analyses on that large set of data as if it was one big experiment.
We should also point out that The mere fact that BEM has published this article, BEM is a fairly well-respected scientist, and if he's right, he will go down in history as, you know, a brave scientist who stood up against the establishment and was proven right. I wouldn't bet on that if I were you. And his study, independent of replication, has come in for rather severe criticism. In fact, the JPSP in the print edition published a criticism article of BEM's paper, and in this paper they conducted a Bayesian analysis of BEM's data and found no results. So don't think that just because this has been published in a peer-reviewed journal it's true. That's just a proxy for it being, for it meeting some minimum requirement. It's a bit like being over the age of 18 and being let into a bar. Just because you've been let into the bar doesn't mean you're wonderful and attractive and highly desirable. It just means you meet the minimum requirement of being 18 years old. And the same thing goes for journal articles. It meets some minimum requirements of accuracy and statistical competence and so on. But that doesn't mean it's true. Okay.
Oh, all right. Well, that's our news for today. So we'll be moving on to our feature.
This is Dr. Stephen Novella from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but right now you're listening to Consilience.
We're going to put on our Big Pharma shill hats and talk about vaccinations today.
Oh, God,
yes,
yeah.
You can send my check to.
Yes, Adcock Ingram, we're waiting for our checks.
Oh, and just to mention, we will continue with our big history series next week. But we thought vaccinations would be more awesome this week.
Quite right. All right, so vaccinations. What are vaccinations? Now, a vaccination is a medical intervention which is designed to introduce a kind of pathogen, so that's a disease or a toxic substance, into your body in order to train your immune system to fight off similar infections in the future. So in other words, do you have a common virus which is potentially dangerous? You might take a vaccine which is designed to protect you from that virus. And it protects you by priming or teaching your immune system how to recognize that virus so that it can fight it off more quickly in the future. So there are a bunch of different kinds of vaccines. There isn't just the one kind. Probably two of the better known kinds are so-called killed vaccines and live vaccines. Now, a killed vaccine is when a pathogen is a disease-bearing organism, so like a virus or a bacterium or a fungus in some occasions, is when a pathogen has been stripped of its ability to reproduce. So all you've got left is the outer shell, the skin of the pathogen, is then introduced into your body. But now what's interesting about the skin is that it contains things that we call surface proteins. So these are little Lego blocks, puzzle piece shapes that connect to other molecules in your body, and it's these shapes that your immune system is trained to recognize. So once one of your white blood cells, for example, comes into contact with one of these pathogens, it recognizes this particular threat, cross-references it with its internal database of other threats, and is able to mount a suitable response. So with these killed vaccines, the pathogen is introduced, but it's not able to do any harm because it doesn't have its DNA in there anymore. It can't reproduce. It can't actually infect you in any way. All you've got is these foreign objects in your body that your immune system learns to recognize, so that in the future, if you happen to come across somebody who's infected with this, with the actual virus, with a live pathogen, and you get some of that into your system, your immune system is able to recognize and say, okay, all right, we've seen this before, we know what to do, send the troops in, or whatever it might be. The other popular kind is so-called live vaccines. This is when you introduce either a specially cultivated version of the pathogen or a closely related pathogen that is not as virulent into your system in order to do the same thing, to teach your immune system. A historical example of this is when cowpox was used as a vaccine against smallpox. Now, cowpox and smallpox are closely related organisms, but cowpox is a lot less dangerous. Smallpox was a deadly disease. But researchers long time ago, several centuries ago, learned that if you were injected with some of the cowpox pathogen, your body would be able to learn to recognize that, and then you would be functionally immune to smallpox from then on. Now, there are other examples of live vaccines that are used today, which are a bit more sophisticated than the cowpox for smallpox, but the underlying principles are the same.
And you see, cowpox, the smallpox vaccine was developed in 1796.
Right. So that was before the germ theory of disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, for as long as vaccines have been around, there have been controversies about them. Even in the very early days of vaccines, we're talking early 18th century, there were anti-vaccination groups campaigning for, you know, them not to be used.
Quite right, and understandably so. It's a pretty scary idea. Now, you have this big, bad disease that kills people, and now you're getting injected with a little piece of the disease or something similar to the disease. It's a scary concept if you're not familiar with the underlying theory. So I can understand why people might have some reservations, but this is where the science comes in. This is where we do large-scale trials and see, does it actually work? So what we can do is, when you have large-scale implementations of vaccines, let's say the smallpox vaccine is a nice example, when enough people have been inoculated with the smallpox vaccine, smallpox goes away. You just don't get any cases anymore. We've spoken about it before that, as far as we can tell, smallpox is extinct in the wild, because we had in the mid-20th century, we had a worldwide campaign of inoculation against smallpox, and now it's just gone. It's not a thing anymore. And the problem, however, though, is that not everybody can be vaccinated. There are people who are immune compromised. For example, people who, in South Africa in particular, people who are HIV positive or have other immune diseases, these people can't be immunized, because even the vaccine can make them very, very sick.
And young infants as well can't be.
Yes, quite right. Young infants also, that their immune systems aren't developed enough to handle a lot of vaccines yet. So these people are at risk. And for those people, we have to rely on a protective effect of a thing called herd immunity. Now, what this means is, when you have enough people in a population who are immunized, there aren't enough potential hosts available to a pathogen to be able to propagate itself. So in other words, if 99 out of 100 people are immunized against a disease, there's no way for that disease to go. There's no path through those 99 people to get to that one person who hasn't been immunized. So that's the gold standard in immunization campaigns, is to try and get to that herd immunity status. It varies from vaccine to vaccine, but generally it seems to be around the 90% mark. If 90% of people in a population are vaccinated, then you're bound to have herd immunity, which means that there's just, you know, you're pretty much protected from that disease. So this is what would have happened in smallpox, is you can't immunize everybody against smallpox, but as long as you're immunizing 90% of the vulnerable population on the planet, the disease just has nowhere to go, and it dies out. It doesn't have enough food. It can't go anywhere. So when we had in the late 20th century a worldwide campaign to try and eradicate polio the way we did smallpox, there were anti-vaccination movements that popped up in West Africa that managed to undermine those efforts and caused some populations in that region to fail to reach that herd immunity. So now you had populations that weren't adequately covered, so polio was able to spread in those regions, and now polio still exists in the world today because of exactly that. We weren't able to reach that herd immunity status. Now, it's not the end of the world. We could still someday perhaps reach herd immunity on polio, but we're not there yet. But while we're talking about these anti-vaccine activists, it's probably a good idea to talk about some of the misconceptions that people have about vaccines, because there's a lot of misinformation. It's a fairly complicated idea. And as we said, it's a scary notion, and anti-vaccine people have been around for a long time who've been propagating misconceptions about it. So let's look at some of the big ones. Probably the most common one is that the vaccines can give you the disease. Now, this one on the surface kind of makes a bit of sense, because you're getting injected with some of the disease or something similar. You might think that this would give you the disease, but that's just not the case. As we've already spoken about, you're not getting the actual disease. You're getting a variably cultured version, or a related version, or a killed version. It's not the actual disease. So you're not going to get the disease in most cases. There are exceptions. As we spoke about the polio vaccine, in West Africa, in some of the areas that failed to reach herd immunity, people who got the live vaccine were unfortunately spread that live vaccine to their unprotected community members. So now what we have in some regions of Western Africa is a whole separate strain of polio that is descended from the live polio vaccine, and that is a direct result of the failure to reach herd immunity in that area. Another common complaint you might have heard from people, especially if friends and family have received the influenza vaccine, which goes around every year, is that once they've had the vaccine, then they get the disease anyway. They still get the flu. Now, this is a common misconception, because it's a fairly common reaction to the influenza vaccine that you'll probably experience some flu-like symptoms for a day or two after the jab. What's happening there is that your immune system is recognizing the surface proteins on that killed virus and is mounting an immune response to that killed virus.
We should mention, by the way, that the evidence for efficacy for vaccines vary. So the seasonal flu vaccine, for example, is of doubtful use. There have been various Cochrane collaboration studies on these vaccinations, and for, if I'm speaking from memory now, but as I remember it, for children above the age of 2, it was somewhat better than placebo, but for adults, especially older adults, the effect was much lower. And the reason for this is not that the principle of vaccination is problematical, it's because the flu vaccines in circulation change dramatically over time. The flu virus varies a lot because it evolves all the time. And it's not just one thing, right? There are numerous different cold and flu viruses around, and they evolve all the time, and they change, and they circulate in interesting patterns. And what the vaccine makers have to do is they try to predict what the upcoming season's flu will be, and then try to tailor the vaccine they produce to the prevalence, the strains that they think will be prevalent. And this doesn't always work, and even when it works, it's not 100% effective. So it's entirely possible to take a seasonal flu vaccine and still get the flu.
Right.
The effect will be statistical. I do believe that the evidence is somewhat equivocal for the flu vaccine, but it's not for something like polio. And just, I should mention that the Cochrane Collaboration is an organization based in the UK that does systematic reviews of evidence and meta-analyses of large data sets for all sorts of medical claims. So they'll investigate the efficacy of reflexology for heart disease, for example, and then look at all the studies that have ever been published on this question, and then analyze them and produce a report. And this is this movement, this Cochrane Collaboration, is sort of at the heart of evidence-based medicine.
Quite right. Now one shouldn't be confused instances where the vaccine fails, like you mentioned, and instances where you just have the ordinary vaccine reaction, where you're having your immune response to the killed vaccine, which will make you feel groggy for a couple of days, but it won't even be as bad as a cold, which lasts for a week, and orders of magnitude less severe than the actual flu, which can, you know, potentially be life-threatening if you get it.
Something that we have to just think about here is not necessarily with the flu vaccine itself, but it's not like we've only just started giving a few people a few vaccines. We have decades of experience with millions of doses of vaccines. This is not something new. It's, in my opinion, one of the greatest medical advances in all of human history. And we're not just giving people a random jab. We are testing and developing over years this body of knowledge. We know it works.
Quite right. We'll cover in a future episode how things like large-scale placebo-controlled trials and that sort of thing work. But suffice to say, we have an enormous body of evidence that we draw upon when we're making claims about efficacy of vaccines. And Michael was quite right to say that the efficacy of vaccines varies from vaccine to vaccine. I mean, there are many different kinds, many different pathogens, and some are more effective than others. But when it comes to life-threatening illnesses, things like smallpox, polio, and even more conventional ones that we think of as being ordinary diseases, things like measles, mumps, rubella, pertussis, things like that, these can also be life-threatening for children. And if we can protect them using statistically significantly efficacious interventions, then it's probably a good idea. If we can lessen the chances of our child getting whooping cough at a young age to less than 10%, that's pretty good odds.
I think we should move on to the next commonly held misconception, which is that vaccines are being forced down our throats by Big Pharma. And if I can quote a comment on my Facebook page, herd community, my purple foot. The only difference here is you spent approximately R1,000 on nothing, like the rest of the herd. Oh, and the rich pharmaceutical wankers are on a yacht as we speak, drinking a martini and smoking cigars while your little boy has chickenpox. My little boy has chickenpox at the moment. It's a no-brainer, really, and don't give me the science jumble. You're not a scientist, and you defend something so passionately without a clue. Well, yeah, Big Pharma.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Big Pharma, or the large pharmaceutical companies, they are profit-making entities. They really are companies that are in the business of making profit. The way they do that is by making medical interventions that work reliably most of the time. As their alternative health departments notwithstanding, for the most part, these interventions actually do work, and that's how they make money, by selling things that work. They deliver the goods.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's tested, and we can see that it does dramatically impact the incidence of severe, debilitating, deadly diseases.
Quite right. And yeah, sure. I mean, when whenever you have the possibility of large amounts of profit, there's always the possibility of some kind of corruption or that kind of thing. It's hard to say. But there are, in most countries, very strict government oversight on these sorts of things. Vaccines in the United States are subject to regulation by at least two different government agencies. These things are tested very, very stringently, and they're not going to let you put just anything into your body. But also, any intervention, not just vaccines, have made it through something like the Food and Drug Administration's approval, they still continue to collect data on safety and efficacy once it's in the market. And if they realize that the balancing act between safety and efficacy is tilting in the wrong direction, they will pull that product and replace it with something else. Something that might not be as efficacious, but it's safer, or whatever it might be. And that's what these things are. It's a balancing act, as with any medical intervention.
And just because you support science does not mean you necessarily have to support the pharmaceutical industry. You can take the middle road approach, which is, let's favor the evidence. Now, the research about research has been done on whether pharmaceutical companies skew published results. And it's been demonstrated that studies funded by the pharmaceutical industry are far more likely to be reported as positive. And sometimes this is the result of subconscious bias, and in rare cases it's the result of outright fraud. But just because we support vaccines does not mean we like large multinational corporations. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But the point is, you favor the scientific evidence. You don't necessarily have to. It's a false choice to think you either are in the pay of the pharmaceutical industry, or you're in favor of, you know, natural remedies or whatever the case might be. And it's silly for various reasons. One, because you can support a group some of the time, but not all of the time, like we do with the pharmaceutical industry. And just because one group is bad does not mean their competitors are good. So, for example, Big Pharma competes against Big Alt or Big Alternative Medicine, which, by the way, in often cases, these companies are owned by large pharmaceutical firms anyway. So don't fall into the trap of buying into a false dichotomy between either you completely support the pharmaceutical industry or you completely support, you know, alternative medicine. The proper way, in my opinion, to go about it is to look at the scientific evidence, and some of the time the pharmaceutical industry are lying bastards, and some of the time they're not. And when they're not lying or trying to exploit people, then you support them, and when they are, you don't support them.
I think we've probably mentioned this before on the podcast. As non-scientists, as non-experts, I defer to the consensus of the scientific community, and I defer to the consensus of the medical community, as the case may be.
And just recall as well that there's a large independent medical academic community in the world, and these people conduct tests on pharmaceutical products all the time, and they're not in the pay of the pharmaceutical industry in very many cases.
Another aspect to this, the vaccine controversy, is further conspiracy theories relating to vaccines. One in particular was introduced by Andrew Wakefield about 10 years ago now, in which, when he published a paper in the Lancet Journal, if I'm not mistaken, in which he drew a connection between vaccination, I think it was the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and autism. He was claiming that that autism was caused by this vaccine. Specifically, the things that were stuck in the vaccine, things like mercury and formaldehyde and various other dangerous chemicals. And this has spawned a whole new anti-vaccination movement bent on propagating the idea that vaccines are dangerous for your children, spearheaded by their new public face, Jenny McCarthy, a former Playboy playmate, and that seems to be about her only qualification.
And don't forget that she's a mommy.
Oh, right, she has her
mommy. Use her mommy instinct to trump scientific evidence.
Right, exactly. Mommy instinct beats science every time. So that's what happens, is these people make various claims about things that are in vaccines, things like mercury in particular. Formaldehyde is another one that they pick on. Formaldehyde is a chemical often used to preserve specimens. If you've ever been in a biology lab in a high school and you see all the animal fetuses lined up on a wall, those are generally stored in formaldehyde. It's also a poisonous chemical that also happens to be present in ordinary human bodies. And various other chemicals that are claimed to be dangerous, and they're suggesting that these vaccines are somehow poisoning the children rather than protecting them from illness. And they're using this as justification to promote the idea that parents shouldn't have their children vaccinated, which is threatening to, and in some places already has, threatened the herd immunity in certain areas. And when considering that Jenny McCarthy has a considerably sized soapbox on Oprah Winfrey's show, it means she's able to get her message out to a lot of people, which is a problem.
Well, it is true that the incidence of autism has increased dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years. it is not been demonstrated that this is this large increase is due to a real increase in the incidence of autism. Because what seems to have happened is that the autism spectrum has widened. So people who, or children who would not have been classified as autistic in 1980 are now being classified as autistic. So what counts as an autistic individual has broadened significantly, and as a result, we're seeing an increase in the number of autistic children.
Now, this is how Jenny McCarthy got involved, because she has a son who she claimed was autistic and who received his autism from his vaccinations, and who she then cured of his autism using various alternative interventions. And Jenny McCarthy has become the self-appointed spokesmodel of the anti-vaccination movement, to such an extent that a website has been created called the JennyMcCarthyBodyCount.com. This is a somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, counter which records how many people have become ill from vaccine-preventable illnesses, but got ill in areas where they shouldn't have, because the vaccines are available in those areas, and not only illnesses, but also vaccine-preventable deaths. Now, there's a third counter on the website, and that is the number of autism diagnoses scientifically linked to vaccinations. So this is how many people have been proven to have received autism from their vaccinations, and that count remains at zero, whereas the number of preventable illnesses count, as I'm looking at it right now, reads 77,713, and the number of preventable deaths count reads at 717. Now, I believe that's just in the continental United States, where those statistics are brought from the Centers for Disease Control, if I'm not mistaken. So who knows what those counts might be in other areas. I know that Australia has a strong anti-vaccination movement as well.
And to be clear, Andrew Wakefield's paper that he published in The Lancet in 1998 has been demonstrated to be wrong. Various replications have been done, and his results are incorrect. In fact, the journal went as far as to withdraw the study, saying it's so discredited we no longer even want it on our archive. And more than that, recently Brian Deer, a journalist who has been investigating Wakefield for a number of years, at least 5 or 6 years, has published a series of articles in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, demonstrating, or at least alleging, that not only were Wakefield's results wrong, they were actually positively fraudulent. It's already been known for quite a while that Wakefield had undisclosed conflicts of interest. For example, he was being paid by a firm of lawyers who were trying to sue the makers of the MMR vaccine before he even published his study in The Lancet. But Brian Deer alleges that Wakefield, in fact, engaged in fraud, scientific misconduct. And numerous studies have been done, both experimental and epidemiological, since this controversy arose, and they've all shown conclusively that autism cannot be caused by vaccine. That's not to say we know what causes autism. It is quite probably mostly genetic, but it's very unclear what causes it. But we can say with near certainty that vaccines is not one of the causes.
So the question is, where does this association between vaccinations and autism come from? Well, the thing is that autism symptoms are usually first noticed at around the same age that children tend to receive a lot of vaccinations. So that's around 18 months, 2 years old. A false attribution fallacy. So people see two things that occur close together in time and assume that the one caused the other. It's an ordinary human mistake to make, but it's a dangerous one in this case.
In fact, what Deer alleges Wakefield has done in some cases is taken the chronology of a particular patient out of context to change the chronology in some way. So even though symptoms of autism showed up before the vaccine, he would move it around in his data and make it look like it happened afterwards. We should also mention that Andrew Wakefield was struck from the medical role in Great Britain, so he's no longer allowed to practice medicine in the UK, but he's set up a practice in the United States, which has somewhat more lax laws when it comes to this kind of thing, and it varies by state, and he's continuing on in his campaign to discredit vaccines and to allege that autism is caused by vaccines. There's a long and very good profile of him in, I think, last week's New York Times, which we will link to, can read if you are interested in more information about him.
So what's the moral of the story here is, don't take medical advice from Playboy Playmates. sorry, we had one announcement this week, and that is coming up, the ScopeX Astronomy and Telescope Expo here in Johannesburg. It's happening on Saturday, the 7th of May, and that's happening at the War Museum at the Johannesburg Zoo in Parktown in Joburg. There's an entrance fee to the museum that's 22 Rand for adults and 11 Rand for seniors and for children under 9. Now, it's a double whammy, because not only do you get to see the Telescope and Astronomy Expo, but you get to see the War Museum as well. All the exhibits are still in place, and it's worthwhile checking out if you haven't seen it or if you haven't seen it recently. And the Astronomy Expo itself is a lot of fun. There are all kinds of talks, and there are exhibitors who are selling their wares. There are other people who've built their own telescopes and are showing it off. In the evening on the Saturday, there's also a star party where you can bring your own telescope, set it up, and we can all look at the sky together. We're hoping to be there, and we might be able to record some interviews or something while we're there. We'll see how that goes. If you're interested, we'll link in the show notes to the PlanCast Facebook and official websites of the event, and we hope to see you there.
Cool. So, that's all we have this week. Angela has popped off to take care of her son, who's in some distress. So, on her behalf, I say goodbye, and for me as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to conciliencecast@gmail.com. The music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
Starting off as always with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
I've lost my place!
That didn't take long.
Please leave it in.
One paragraph in, then you've already lost your place.